We talk a lot about hearts in the month of February. It's hard not to with Valentine's Day right smack in the middle and all those red symmetrical hearts on display in the stores. So this part of the month, a week after Valentine's Day, might be the best time to point out that it is also American Heart Month, a chance for all of us to hear a few reminders about the proper care and feeding of the human heart. And by care and feeding of the human heart, we mean in the physical sense, not the poetic sense. Our guest is a cardiologist, Brian Morrison, who's with Southern Oregon Cardiology. Thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Let's talk about cardiology generally. I mean, is this a science that has really advanced just over the course of your career?
It is amazing in my 20 years how far we've come. There's a tremendous amount of clinical research that goes on in cardiology where the science of what we do, how we eat, how we act, our medications has really come along to the point where we're seeing a very significant reduction in death from heart attack and actually longevity in our lives.
Well, so have some of the sciences come along to the point where people who once might have died from heart disease do not any longer? Are the procedures in place to keep that many more people alive than was once possible?
Absolutely. And there's so many things that go into that. In general, people are living better, smoking less, exercising more. And over a lifetime, that plays a very large role. But on a day-to-day basis, if you have a heart attack today, your chances of survival and, more importantly, meaningful recovery and return to active life are far greater than they were even just 10 or 20 years ago.
Really? So even within the last couple of decades, so certainly over the course of the lifetime of a young person. The heart itself, let's start general. What's at the top of the list for good prevention?
Don't hurt yourself. Take care of yourself in a smart way. Don't smoke. Eat reasonably. And exercise. Those three basic things will get you a lot with your heart.
All right. So the first one is a don't smoke, but then the eating well and the exercising. Of those two, is either one more important than the other?
I think they're both important. However, if you ask me which you get more with, I would say daily exercise, you know, walking 30 minutes, 5, 6, 7 times a week will get you a very significant advancement in your life expectancy and in your quality of life. Eating, you know, we hear about eating and diets every single day, and I think we all have the message about that.
Right. So you're not going to add anything to that, I could say. But as you look at the cascade of information, and I don't know how much you pay attention to popular media or mass media, but it does seem to be a constant bombardment of things, particularly in terms of like, well, it's okay to eat a little bit of this, or it's okay to eat a little bit of that, or no, a new study shows that's not the case. I mean, from a person who's dealing with having to treat people with heart disease, what's your perspective on the constant barrage of information?
It is absolutely a barrage, and sometimes I'm overwhelmed because one day it's this and one day it's that. I think that the take-home message for your heart health would be, number one, everything in moderation. Number two, think about your basic food groups, vegetables and fruits and nuts, and making that a staple of your diet every day and really cutting back on processed things. What I tell my patients, if someone wraps it up and hands it to you, it's probably not that good for you.
Really?
Really.
Meaning what?
Well, I think that if you're at home and you're making your food and you're making it from basic ingredients, you're going to be okay. It's okay to have a few eggs. It's okay to have a little bit of meat. It's okay to cook with a little bit of butter. However, if you're going out or someone's making it for you, things are saturated with those kinds of ingredients in a way to get you to eat more, to buy more, and in turn, that's not very healthy.
Ah, okay. So again, moderation here. It's interesting. So if somebody wraps it up for you, better served at home.
It's a simple message that people get.
What about things like, you know, and when I was talking about the barrage of information, the stuff that was popping into my mind was, for example, the information that some red wine is good for your heart, some chocolate is good for your heart. What's the current status of information there?
Well, there are chemical compounds found in red wine and found in dark chocolate that are, in a laboratory, have been found to be very helpful in terms of prevention of normal degradation of cells. On a daily basis and over your lifetime, again, red wine in moderation. If you have a glass or two of wine every day, every other day, you're going to be fine. And when they take a look at survival after a heart attack, for example, if you compare people who do not drink at all and people who drink to excess, those who enjoy a glass or two every day, every other day, have a better survival than the other two groups. Why is that? It's hard to tease that out exactly. Chocolate, again, there are some antioxidant properties of dark chocolate that are good for you. It doesn't mean that you go out and eat three candy bars a day, but if you have a little bit of chocolate and it's a high percentage dark chocolate, that's probably the way to go.
All right, let's talk about the antioxidants, because that term does get slung around a lot. And from the perspective of an MD like yourself, it may be a little have a different meaning to you.
I think that we're always looking for something. If I take this, that'll take the place of what occurs naturally. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. So I think you look for your antioxidants in your foods, in your natural foods. And so green leafy vegetables, blueberries, you know, basic natural foods will have those. And if you incorporate those foods into your diet over a lifetime, that is where the benefit comes.
Why blueberries rather than some other berries? What's in those?
I'm just not a nutritionist, Jeffrey. Okay. I can't answer that question, but that particular fruit really stands out as a very healthy fruit.
Dr. Brian Morrison is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a cardiologist with Southern Oregon Cardiology. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the care and feeding of the human heart. And yes, we are talking in the physical sense. Our phone number is on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Mark in Redding is calling in. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Brian Morrison.
Good morning. What is your opinion on taking an aspirin a day as a preventative for heart attack? And if one has a heart attack, is it a good idea to take 2 to 4 aspirin prior to getting medical attention if one is not immediately available, you know, if medical attention is not immediately available?
All right, good question about aspirin and its use in the bloodstream. Thanks for that, Mark.
Mark, I think that's a great point to bring up. There are very, very good large-scale clinical trials that show for both men and women over the age of 50, if you take a baby aspirin a day, you will have a significant decreased risk of heart attack, stroke, and also colon cancer. So it's a very good preventative. The only reason to not take a baby aspirin a day would be that if it causes significant stomach upset, and you should talk to your doctor about that. If you're asking me if you're having heart attack symptoms or even stroke symptoms, absolutely, to take 325 milligram aspirin or 4 baby aspirin, which would be the same dose, take that immediately, chew it up. It doesn't taste very good, but chew it up so it gets into your bloodstream quickly, and then call 911.
Really? And what will be the effect of, what's the long-term effect and what is the short-term effect in this instance?
Well, the short-term effect is immediate effect on your body's platelet cells, which are clumping together to cause that blockage, which is causing a heart attack or stroke. So that's been shown to have a measurable effect on your survival with a heart attack. Long-term, taking an aspirin a day has two effects. There's the obvious blood thinning effect that we all think about and can feel with a little bit of bruising or sometimes that people have. But more importantly, aspirin has very important what we call anti-inflammatory properties that over the long term decrease the progression of atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries over your lifetime.
And why do you say baby aspirin? What's the difference between that and regular aspirin?
That's a great point. More recently, studies have shown that the majority of people get the same benefit in terms of your cardiovascular benefit with a baby aspirin versus 325. However, the risk of stomach upset and stomach bleeding is far less at that smaller dose. Aspirin has been made into 325 milligram pill for 100 years, and so that's why we always just said take an aspirin, but getting by with a little less is probably advisable.
Aspirin is actually kind of an interesting story from a marketing perspective because it was a brand name at one time, and it just got used so much to describe the product that it became used for all products by that name. They lost their trademark on it, I think is what happened. Let's talk about how prone men are to heart disease and conversely, whether women seem to be catching up.
Well, this is a very good point to bring up, and the recognition of heart disease in women, let's say 30, 40 years ago, was felt that women just didn't have heart attacks like men do, and we know that there's absolutely no difference between men and women. I think in a population basis that women perhaps develop heart disease a bit later in life than men do, and that's believed to be because of some protective effect of hormones, but that's really on a large scale. For an individual person, I think the same factors apply. If you smoke, if you have high blood pressure, if you have high cholesterol, diabetes, and a family history of heart disease, those are the 5 major risk factors that go into whether or not you yourself will have heart disease. you need to know about what are my risk factors. Do I have any of those? Are they being treated? Am I taking care of myself? But for women and men, to me, I think they're equally at risk.
As you talk about the advances in cardiology and the ability to treat ailments of the heart, I mean, these developments are happening at the very same time that we're talking about an obesity epidemic, particularly in the United States. So while you're able to treat things better, are you also seeing more cases? Are the rates of heart attacks, is the rate of heart disease actually going up with the obesity?
That's a very good point. I just to talk about obesity just for a second, clearly our society has become heavier over time, and there are so many reasons why that is, and it's alarming in children, the rates of obesity in children, and obese children tend to be obese adults. And why is that bad? Because of these other things that occur to a higher percentage in obese people. Blood pressure, higher. Diabetes, higher. Cholesterol, not particularly. But with diabetes and higher blood pressure, then you do have an earlier onset of symptomatic heart disease than you would otherwise. So, yes.
All right. And is the age coming down then because of obesity? Are we seeing heart attacks in younger people?
When we see a heart attack in a young person, and for me, you almost never see a heart attack under the age of 40, but occasionally you do. And when you do, you're going to have someone with, they smoke, they are heavy, they have high blood pressure, they have a family history of heart disease, they have all the risk factors to be that early. But in a general sense, instead of someone having a heart attack at 70, maybe we're seeing it now at 55 or 60. Sure, absolutely.
Dr. Brian Morrison is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Southern Oregon Cardiology. We're talking about the care of the human heart and the treatment of it when things go wrong. You can join us here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number is 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Morrison.
Howdy. Could you differentiate between a heart attack and a stroke? I've had a stroke a couple years ago, and I'm still a little unclear on, what separates the two.
All right. Thanks for that, Steve. Appreciate it.
Well, Steve, the difference, there's a commonality between the two, and that is that there is a disease of the blood vessel. The blood vessel to the heart is called the coronary artery. If you have a blockage in that blood vessel to your heart, the heart muscle will begin to die and have damage within minutes, and that's what we call a heart attack. If that blood vessel is going to your brain, lack of blood flow because of a blocked artery to your brain for more than 3 or 4 minutes will cause permanent damage to the brain, and that's what we call a stroke. So the basic principle is the same, but the parts of the body are different.
For a while there, it seemed like we were calling strokes brain attacks. That was coming into vogue in the medical community, and yet just as quickly, it seems like that has stopped. Are we referring to those as strokes full-time again?
Well, I think the reason for that was to emphasize the need for rapid treatment and action for stroke, just like we do for heart attacks. Everybody knows you have a heart attack, go to the hospital immediately. With a stroke, perhaps people just didn't think about it the same way or recognize the symptoms of stroke. So I think the push to call it a brain attack was to emphasize the need for speed, seek medical attention so that your treatment can begin sooner and have less of an effect on your long-term brain function.
Well, it seemed to work for a little while because I know that having some of the people from the Asante Health System in here that they were talking about time is brain. I got that drummed into my head that the faster you act, the faster you can limit the damage.
Absolutely.
So let us talk about some of the conditions that you end up treating. You have a particular specialty, it appears, in adult congenital heart disease. What's that term mean, ACHD?
Adult congenital heart disease refers to a patient population that is growing exponentially in the United States. Children who are born with congenital heart disease that need a procedure or a heart operation, we like to think that we've cured them, but what we find is that we've helped them and stabilized them and palliated them. They grow, become teenagers, become young adults, and then adults. And the complexity of their care, because of the nature of the complexity of their congenital heart disease, the operations, procedures, and treatments over a long period of time leave them becoming very, very complex patients. And so my training and specialty allows me to understand perhaps a little better and treat these patients who now number probably 1 million adults in the United States have been survivors of childhood heart surgery.
Is it that the surgery changes the heart structure so much that it's kind of like you need an owner's manual to go with the person?
That's a good way to put it, Jeffrey, yeah.
Really? And so what will a subsequent surgeon find in a situation like that perhaps they wouldn't have found, or even not necessarily a surgeon, but just somebody treating them?
Well, what changes over time is the growth of the patient. You know, the child grows, and so the body grows, the heart changes and grows, things wear out over time. And so understanding all the possibilities, understanding what was in vogue for surgery 20 years ago that is different now, those are the things that are necessary to appropriately take care of these patients today.
So there's some special attention needed then if you have chronic heart disease as a child.
Absolutely. And the understanding that parents of children need to understand that these kids will need long-term care, and the child themselves, as they grow to become adults, understand that they will need long-term care. It's not just, I'm done, I'm fixed, it's all over, but long-term care to allow them to continue to have a very good quality of life, which the vast majority of these people do have.
All right, so there can be a quote-unquote normal life then. I mean, just regular maintenance, though, it sounds like, is what's called for.
Depending upon the complexity and severity of the original congenital heart disease, yes.
Is there often a medication needs to be taken for essentially for a lifespan?
Because the physiology of the patient and their circulation changes over time, nothing is forever. And there are times where medicines are necessary and other times where they're not. But compared to a non-adult congenital heart patient, oftentimes a bit more than you might see without the congenital heart disease.
Let's talk some general advice here then for people who are concerned about, particularly if they're getting older. If you have a family history but no particular symptoms, what should you be doing in the way of getting checked out, and at what ages?
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that teenagers beginning at age 15 have a cholesterol check, and I think that's excellent advice. So if you are the parent, grandparent, or your teenager yourself listening, you should know what your cholesterol is by the time you're 15. High cholesterol leads to heart disease in this country. It is a cause and effect relationship. Should be advised and know what it is and be treated, number one. Number two, you should know what your blood pressure is. And you should know what your blood pressure is when you go to the doctor. What do? They check your heart rate and blood pressure, and you should know it. Do I have high blood pressure? Is it normal? Is it borderline? And if you're concerned about that, you check it on your own. You have a volunteer check it, your neighbor, your mom, your spouse. You go to the pharmacy. But know what your blood pressure is. High blood pressure is still today what we call the silent killer. You don't feel it too much, but over time, it has an effect on your cardiovascular health. Number three, as I started off the show saying, you know, you can't smoke. You can't smoke and get away without having heart disease. It'll catch up to you over your lifetime at some point.
One of our callers here, and I need not mention which one, is a person who has talked about, get off my back. I'm still smoking. My mother lived till she was 90 or something.
There's exception to everything in life. You know, nothing is 100% absolute. But if this caller would like to come along and hang out with me for a day, I'll show him some heart disease.
Yikes. If there is no family history of heart disease, though, I mean, what signs do you need to be aware of if it is actually developing in you? I mean, if nobody in your family has heart attacks and you think you might be having one, what are the things you need to be looking for?
The typical symptom of coronary blockage and coronary heart disease is effort limitation. You're doing something. You're going upstairs. You're bringing in the wood. You're bringing in the groceries. You're taking a walk. You're going down the driveway easy. Coming up the driveway, you're having a hard time. So that could be breathlessness. That could be exceptional fatigue. And more classically, a dull, aching pressure sensation in the central chest. It might go up into your neck. It might go up into your jaw. It might be felt in your shoulders or down your arms. Sometimes in women, they feel it between their shoulder blades in the back, a dull achiness. It is relieved with rest, brought on by exertion. So that is the kind of symptom that is a warning sign for maybe I'm having a problem. It never hurts to ask somebody to check it out.
You should not leave it unchecked for any amount of time, it sounds like. I mean, is this immediate medical attention if you start feeling the dull ache?
I think immediate, well, if it stops when you rest and then it comes back the next time, yeah, you should call your doctor and make an appointment. A dramatic symptom, which brings on nausea, sweatiness, really getting out of breath. Yes, that to me is immediate medical attention.
You were talking about the tools and the technology available for treating heart disease now. I understand that you're an affiliate associate professor at Oregon Health Sciences University.
Yes.
Do you do any distance work there? I mean, I know that there was some installation of material at Rogue Regional Medical Center not terribly long ago. Oh. Is that one of the tools at your disposal?
Well, what I do with OHSU is I'm part of their group that takes care of kids and adults with congenital heart disease. And given the size of our state and the distance to Portland, it's really nice to have kind of a satellite person, you know, down here in Medford. They like that. I like it because I like to continue to have an academic tie. It's intellectually stimulating, and I get to be part of the new things and be able to bring those back here to Southern Oregon.
And finally now, because we're almost out of time here, just walking 30 minutes a day sounds fairly simple. Are we talking a good, you know, pump your arms kind of walk, or is just a regular walk doing? And what is the good that it does?
Two good questions. Exercise over your lifetime will make you live better and live longer. You know, we all start to feel it. Some people start to feel it in your 40s, others in your 50s, others in your 60s, but you feel the drag that nature provides in bringing us down. So by exercising, you can prolong all of that. Walking, it takes nothing more than just the effort to make the effort to do it. You don't have to walk fast. If you walk fast, you get more benefit, but just a regular walk, 30 minutes over a lifetime is what makes the difference. It encourages stimulation of healthy blood vessels and a stronger heart, and that's what keeps us going.
All right. We've learned so much, and obviously there's much more to learn. We'll have you back at some point to talk more about heart care. Dr. Brian Morrison is with Southern Oregon Cardiology and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. This is American Heart Month. Thanks so much for joining us on the Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Short break, and then we'll come back with Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac. Please stay tuned.